Erik Friesen tells us, Gustav Holst was English to the core, born and raised, a friend of Rayfon Williams and very much a musical product of his time. Like his fellow British composers, he incorporated English folk song into his works, but was also deeply influenced by the new wave of continental upstarts like Stravinsky, Schoenberg, and Ravel. Although remembered today mostly for the planets, he would write hundreds of works, including operas, ballets, string suites, band suites, choral hymns, and songs. Holst wrote The Planets during the First World War in the years between 1914 and 1917, but it didn't have its first complete public performance until 1920. Friesen suggests further that if Holst were alive today, he might be described as a composer with New Age tendencies. He was much taken by Buddhism, Hindu spiritualism, theosophy, and astrology. His view of the seven planets is based not on astronomy, but on the astrological characteristics of each planet, as was understood in the astrology of the time, particularly in that of his friends, the astrologers Alan Leo and Clifford Bax. When asked about his interest in astrology, Holst replied, "As a rule, I only study things that suggest music to me." The key word in that quote is suggest, because true composers are artists first, and only then apologists for various belief systems. While astrological qualities of the planets may have been a spark for the creative beginnings of the planets, Holst's goal was to create a lasting and magnificent work for large modern orchestra that expressed all he had learned and incorporated in his development as a composer, which is why today we may put aside a belief or interest in astrology, while at the same time enjoying this supreme musical achievement. The Planets is in seven movements, representing seven of the eight known planets of Gustav Holst's day. They are heard roughly in the order of their distance from the sun, but Holst switched the places of Mars and Mercury, probably because he wanted a dramatic opening movement, and Mars gave him that. He omitted Earth because of his astrological focus. Each of the planets represents a different human mood or character. He scored it for a huge orchestra, appropriate for a subject beyond our imagining in size and scope. Mars was named for the Roman god of war, and in the astrology of Holst's day, the planet was known as the destroying angel and the wrath of God. The movement opens in an ominous and sinister march in 5-4 time, surging forward into a battering, dissonant fury which matches or surpasses anything Igor Stravinsky could have imagined. Interestingly, Holst imagined and sketched this movement some months before the outbreak of the First World War. Like Mahler and Elgar before him, Holst may have sensed where Europe was heading, and this opening movement is a hauntingly prescient expression of what was to come in the trenches. Venus, the bringer of peace. For Holst's astrologer friend Alan Leo, Venus was the unifier, producing order out of chaos, harmony out of discord. This movement opens with a lonely French horn solo. answered by a small chamber choir of winds. Friesen hears in this music the stillness, the timelessness of space. This is our solar system at play and at peace, absent solar flares and storms, described at times by very English-sounding pastoral music. Holst wrote Venus in his rural retreat of Thaxted, a small Essex town, and Friesen can imagine his being deeply influenced by this world away from London and the drums of war. Skipping ahead to Jupiter, the bringer of jollity. Jupiter is the best known of the planets, often excerpted as a standalone piece. It's a fabulous explosion of merrymaking, festivity, and revelry, as that very English word, jollity, suggests. But at the heart of this movement is one of Holst's most inspired big tunes, the tune he called Thaxted after his Essex retreat, and which later became the setting for the patriotic hymn, I Vow to Thee My Country, often sung at Remembrance Day ceremonies and widely remembered as one of Princess Diana's favorite hymns. Astrologer Alan Leo's view of Jupiter was a planet of happiness and abundance, but also of inspiring devotion through service. People under the sway of this planet possess that true religious spirit which gives faith and abundant hope. So within the outer wrapping of joy and celebration is the vision or call to something else, not blind patriotism for Holst, but a vision of a true egalitarian community. It's a hymn tuned to rival Hubert Parry's Jerusalem. Words of Eric Friesen in the essay Planetary Mood Pictures in Queen's Quarterly, Fall 2012. We've just done what Gustav Holst deplored. We've ended our discussion with Jupiter, leaving Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune in the mist. But we are invited to a performance of the whole suite with the Wyoming Seminary Civic Orchestra under the direction of Dr. Rick Hoffenberg, May 7th in Kingston and May 8th in Scranton. The orchestra will be joined by a women's chorus for the planets and for the nocturnes for orchestra of Claude Debussy. Dr. Hoffenberg paid a visit to the WVIA studios to speak with us about the planets and the nocturnes and the Wyoming Seminary Civic Orchestra.
It is a complicated project. I decided early on in the year that I wanted to do a complete performance of The Planets by Holst. And that's a complicated undertaking in a number of ways. First of all, it's a huge orchestra. Typical standard orchestra might be double winds, two flutes, oboes, clarinets, and so forth. A large orchestra might be three of each. The Holst is four of each. So you have, you know, four of the flutes, four of different types of oboes for clarinets, bassoons, and so forth. Same for trumpets, six horns. So huge orchestra in addition to some very unusual instruments. And then one thing that many people don't know about the planets, people who are familiar with Mars and Jupiter, certainly most famous movements, they don't know how it ends. It ends in a creative and really ingenious way with a female chorus singing no text, just a wordless female chorus, and Holst directed that they be invisible. He was very specific. He wanted them in an adjoining room with the door initially open, and then he wanted the door to gradually be closed so that the audience had the effect of the chorus or the sound gradually fading away to nothing. And it ends a cappella. The chorus ends the planet. So you have to have a really capable group of female choristers in addition to this massive orchestra. And to couple with that, I decided to do, we had never done, since I've directed Civic Orchestra, never done any impressionistic music, nothing by Debussy or Ravel. Debussy wrote a wonderful set of three pieces called The Nocturnes. And the third movement of The Nocturnes also uses a wordless female chorus. So as long as we were going through the trouble of arranging these ensembles to work together, I thought we might as well take advantage of it and do this other piece. And just using that element as the link, they use the chorus in such different ways. In the Debussy, they're on stage, but Debussy didn't want them in a sort of traditional setup where they might be on risers at the back of the orchestra. He wanted them part of the orchestra. He uses them like an additional instrument in the orchestra. So we're going to have them actually right behind the orchestra, not up on risers in a separate choral format. And I think the audience will be interested to hear how he weaves the chorus in and out of the instrumental lines. It's brilliant.
We think about the planets, but it's not just a Copernican traveling through the solar system, is it?
No, as a matter of fact, it's astrological rather than astronomical, which is why there's no Earth. Holst was introduced to astrology by a friend of his, a man by the name of Clifford Bax, the brother of the famous composer. They were vacationing in Mallorca in 1913, and Clifford was an astrologer, and he gained a new fan in Holst. He became fascinated with astrology, and he started the planets the next year. Well, interestingly enough, the working title was simply Seven Pieces for Large Orchestra, not initially The Planets. Now, that title may in turn have come from a performance that he heard earlier in 1914 of one of Schoenberg's great orchestral works, Five Pieces for Orchestra, which were performed in January of 1914. And in terms of the orchestration, I think they definitely had an influence on Holst. And of course, the working title also bears that resemblance. So Holst later applied the titles of the seven planets, aside from Earth, the seven planets in the solar system that we knew at the time. And the piece went on to become, of course, immensely popular. And it was one of these situations in which Holst actually, the composer, resented its popularity. He felt it overshadowed pieces that he liked better. And, you know, of course, for many years, Pluto was considered a planet, and now it's not. Once again, we have the seven planets aside from Earth. But the classification of Pluto as a planet happened while Holst was still alive, and he was asked to compose a Pluto movement to go along with it. He had no interest whatsoever. He didn't want to revisit this planet that had, you know, sort of taken over his fame. So even though it really is that piece, Holst would not be as famous without the planets, he still resented it. I think it's an analogous situation maybe to Ravel with Bolero. Clearly not Ravel's best piece, but his most famous piece and one that gained him fame, and Rachmaninoff with a C-sharp minor prelude, which begrudgingly he would play at recitals, even though he wrote it when he was barely more than a kid, and certainly not his greatest piece. But sometimes, you know, composers don't always get to choose which works become most famous and which become embedded with their fame, and in Holst's case, he would not have chosen the planets.
Why did you choose the planets in addition to wanting to do it to give the orchestra this experience?
Oh, it's a phenomenal piece. It's engaging in so many ways, and it's brilliant in its use of the instruments. And I knew it was a piece that would engage both the orchestra and the audience. And it's a piece that people know about, but most of the movements I think people will not have heard. So you get, it's kind of a win-win situation. You publicize to people that you're doing a performance of the Planets, and people think, oh, I know that, I love that. And a couple of the movements they will know. They'll be able to hum along a couple of the movements. But you'll be able to present to them music that most of them do not know. And so that's always fun to engage them and to try to gather an audience through a piece that they know and love, but yet introduce them to music that they didn't know before coming to the concert. And there really is so much that's brilliant in the way Holst constructed the piece. You can see the influence not only of Schoenberg, but of Stravinsky as well. The Rite of Spring had been performed recently in England, and you see elements of dissonance and angularity in Holst's writing that we've been kind of numbed to nowadays. But it's really interesting when you study the score. There is really challenging writing for the winds and strings alike. It's a wonderful challenge for the orchestra, and it allows us to work on color too. There are very mystical, ethereal movements that I think allow us to work on ensemble. And so there's just so much to sink our teeth into. It was an easy choice.
With the chorus, as you have explained to us, and that beautiful shutting of the door and just trailing off, is that a music of the spheres evocation? What's he evoking there?
Well, it's a good question. When I first heard it, I had the sense of going beyond the solar system. Like, you know, we've gone out to the outer reaches of our solar system, and then these voices gradually fading away. It's as though we're traveling now beyond the solar system and beyond, you know, as it gradually fades to silence, into this infinite landscape. Now, I could be completely wrong. I don't know, because Holst, one clue we have is that Holst hated incomplete performances of the Planets. And he particularly disliked having to end with Jupiter, which I guess some people requested because it has a big, fiery, and triumphant ending. And as Holst said, the reason he didn't like ending with Jupiter was because in real life, endings are generally not happy. That was what he said. So if you apply that statement to the end of the piece as he wrote it, then you think to yourself, well, maybe he was trying to represent something about life in this kind of amorphous, really inconclusive ending. It ends with these very, very complex seven-part chords that just repeat over and over again. It's very inconclusive in the way it just fades away. It's haunting, but in a way it's unsettling too. And so I think people can have different interpretations. My first impression may not have been what he intended.
He also had an interest, in addition to this astrological exploration, in Eastern thought, didn't he?
He did, it's true. And I think you can sense some of that in the way he writes for the instruments. And he was not alone, certainly, in his fascination with Eastern culture. We see that in a lot of composers. We see them broadening to all sorts of non-Western influences. Stravinsky is the most famous example with, you know, his paganism. And I think composers, in moving beyond the 19th century, were trying to break into the representation of non-Western musics. You had, of course, around the same time, you had Bartok and Kodály doing their exploration of Eastern folk musics. So I think it was around this time that composers in the early 20th century were exploring beyond their Western culture.
Now, we don't want you to give your secrets away, but how logistically are you doing the door? Do you have a room and can you do that?
That's a very good question. Well, we're performing this in two different venues. And the venues are very different in terms of what we have available behind the stage. At Wyoming Seminary, where our first performance is taking place, there are actually TV screens, monitors, built in the hallway just behind the concert hall. So we will arrange for those monitors to show me on the podium so that the choir will be able to watch from there. And we can leave the door between the hall and the hallway open and then gradually close that door. So it will be quite true to what Holst requested. Fortunately for us, that hallway is very open and large, so there will be enough room for the singers. And Merriwood, it's a little bit trickier. We're going to have the singers behind the stage. There will be a black curtain that will allow them to be invisible. And with the help of technical gurus at Merriwood, Patrick Toomey and Judy Snyder, who always work wonders from behind the scenes from a technical standpoint, they're going to install a camera on the podium so that that can be broadcast to the back of the stage and somebody will be watching my conducting motions and then conducting for the chorus. So it's tricky.
Well, then the Debussy now.
Right. Well, this is an interesting piece. We don't know as much about its genesis as we do for the Holst. He completed it in 1899, so only less than two decades before the Holst. And it may have had its roots in another piece that he wrote several years earlier that we only know from a description. We don't have a manuscript. The music doesn't survive, but he discussed it in letters and then didn't complete it. So the description of that earlier piece, that it was about night scenes or something along those lines, it sounds very much like the three-movement nocturnes. The Debussy piece in its final form is three short movements. The first movement is called Nuages, or Clouds, and it's very translucent. It has the strings divided in many parts, and it's actually Debussy's only musical depiction of clouds, and it's very interesting how he portrays them as with their kind of slow harmonic motion. It's quite beautiful. And then it's a total contrast to the second movement, which is called in French fête, or festivals, celebrations, and that's a really fun, fast-moving, virtuosic movement with shifting meters. And then the third movement, which is the one involving the female chorus, is called Sirens. And in this movement, he's drawing upon the mythical sirens of Homer fame. And he uses his consummate compositional skill to create this sort of these seductive vocal lines that, again, weave in and out of the orchestra brilliantly. So I think the audience, if they haven't heard the nocturnes, will really appreciate what Debussy accomplished in the piece.
And what's the experience, singer standing next to or surrounded by instruments and instrumentalists, not having a singer up front or behind them?
Well, you know, actually at the time of recording this interview, we actually have not brought the two ensembles together yet, but I'm very much looking forward to seeing how that works. I think it's beneficial to both ensembles to be able to hear and incorporate and respond musically to the other ensemble. So I'm hoping that it's inspirational when we do bring the ensembles together.
Tell us where and when we can find you.
Sure. There are two performances. The first is on Sunday, May 7th at 8 p.m., and that's at the Kirby Center for Creative Arts at Wyoming Seminary in Kingston, not to be confused with the other Kirby Center. And then the second performance on Monday, May 8th, is also at 8 p.m. That's in the auditorium at Merriwood University in Scranton. So hopefully we can get both the Wilkes-Barre area folks and the Scranton folks to come join us. Both performances are free of charge, so hope people will come out.
There's some rumor that you're having something to do with one Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart.
Yes. So we were thrilled when we got invited to participate in the Northeast Pennsylvania Philharmonic's performance of the Mozart Requiem. We've had such great experiences collaborating with the Northeast Pennsylvania Philharmonic, with Maestro Larry Lowe and Dr. Stephen Thomas, who prepares the chorus. We had had a chance to do the Carmina Burana in 2010, I think. Brahms Requiem, I believe, was 2012. Beethoven Ninth Symphony, I think 2 years later, 2014. So we, our singers always have a wonderful experience. To be able to perform with that phenomenal orchestra is really an unparalleled experience. And Mozart Requiem, I mean, what can you say? It's just one of the pinnacles of the repertoire. It's a piece that I think every singer should get to experience. It's something that was certainly on my list to program anyway at some point. So when I found out that this was in their planning, I thought, perfect. So we'll have the chance to do it not just with full orchestra, but with the best orchestra around.
And then you go off in the summer and do opera.
Yeah, so I've been going to Chautauqua Opera now for almost 20 years. It's hard to believe it's been that long, but it's like a second home for me. I spend about 8 weeks there from early June through early August. I'm on the music staff of Chautauqua Opera. I do some accompanying collaborative piano, some vocal coaching, some chorus master. I do the scheduling of the rehearsals and coaching sessions, and it's just a great place. If people have never been to Chautauqua, I urge them, go. It is like a Disneyland for intellectually curious adults. I mean, their daily lecture series are incredible. Concerts every evening, the nation's oldest book club, they have athletic activities, they have things for kids. Really, anybody can find things there if you enjoy water activities. They have this gorgeous lake. It's an amazing place.
What is one of the operatic highlights this season?
Well, in a way, it's hard to pick one. Certainly, one thing that I think will get a lot of attention is the American premiere of Respighi's realization of the Monteverdi Orfeo. And that's actually being performed in the amphitheater, this huge 5,000-seat venue at Chautauqua, which is, it will be interesting to see how this intimate opera, albeit with expanded orchestral moments in Respighi's hands, it will be interesting to see how that translates to a large auditorium. Our artistic director is just brilliant. I'm sure that Stephen Osgood has, he always comes up with creative ideas and inevitably they work out brilliantly. So I know this will be no exception. Another highlight, I think, one of the more interesting choices is the opera Hydrogen Jukebox, which I think was just performed actually at Tri-Cities Opera in Binghamton. So we're gonna give it a whirl this summer at Chautauqua.
Dr. Rick Hoffenberg, music director and conductor of the Wyoming Seminary Civic Orchestra, co-chair of the Department of Music, Theater, and Dance at Marywood University, speaking with us about the upcoming spring concert program of the Civic Orchestra, Sunday, May 7th at the Kirby Center for Creative Arts, Sprague Avenue, Wyoming Seminary in Kingston, and that's just across the river from Wilkes-Barre, and the concert will get underway at 8 p.m. And then again Monday, May 8th at Marywood University in Scranton in the Set La Verghetta Center at 8 p.m. The Civic Orchestra will be joined by women from the Marywood University Concert Choir and Wyoming Seminary Madrigal Singers, and they will present The Planets by Gustav Holst and this work, Claude Debussy's three-movement tone poem, Nocturnes. The Wyoming Seminary Civic Orchestra, performing under the direction of Dr. Rick Hoffenberg, joined by a women's chorus from the Marywood University Concert Choir and the Wyoming Seminary Madrigal Singers. And they will perform Sunday, May 7th at the Kirby Center for Creative Arts on the campus of Wyoming Seminary in Kingston, just across the river from Wilkes-Barre, at 8 p.m. And then they will repeat the performance, and that will be on Monday, May 8th, at Marywood University in Scranton in the Seth Lavergetta Center for the Performing Arts. Also at 8 p.m., the concerts are free and open to the public. For more information, on the web, marywood.edu, marywood.edu. Sunday, May 7th at 8 at the Kirby Center for Creative Arts, Sprague Avenue in Kingston, on the Wyoming Seminary campus, and then again Monday, May 8th at Marywood University in the Seth Lavergetta Center, also at 8. Admission is free. For more information, on the web, marywood.edu, marywood.edu.